The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Our aim is to explore the fringe, lost civilizations, alternative science, the paranormal, and much more. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live or future guests via email or the live chat room. And remember to subscribe to us on iTunes. And now welcome to this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
And welcome to Where Did the Road Go? This is your host, Soraya, as always. And this technically is the first show of year two. And I want to thank everyone who has said, actually, this week I've gotten a lot of really positive comments about the show, and I really appreciate that. It means a lot to me. This show means a lot to me. It's not just a piece of entertainment to me. It's where I further doing my own research as I talk to different people and get different perspectives on everything, as well as being entertaining at times. And tonight, I have brought back two people who were two of my favorite interviews over the last few months, and I figured let's get them together and let's talk UFOs. And so we have Mike Cleland and Aaron Gullius with us. Are you with us? Are you there, guys?
Yes.
We're here.
All right. And yeah, both of you were on in December.
Yep.
And I really wanted to bring both of you back because I so enjoyed having this conversation with you. And it was definitely a conversation with both of you, as opposed to I ask you a question, you talk for 20 minutes. and so that was something else I really enjoyed. Not that I mind when people do that, but it's a different feel when you actually have a conversation with someone about this stuff.
Yeah.
So
I agree. Yes.
And you two have never actually met.
No.
Okay. All right, and so this is a first in many ways. We've never done it. Well, we've had two people on the air before the show. We had Ryan Sproug and Peter Robbins, but Peter was actually in studio. I've never had two people on Skype, so let's hope this works out well.
Yes.
All right, so Mike, you are known, obviously, as the owl guy.
I have for reasons I'm at this point, I am the owl guy, yes. I'm not sure what that actually means. I know that, you know, I'll just say it, you know, Whitley Strieber is, for better or for worse, ended up being the anal probe guy, so yeah. I'm counting my blessings. So.
That's true. And Aaron, you've written two recent books, one, The Extraterrestrials and the American Zeitgeist, and
yes.
The Chaos Conundrum. The first one definitely deals with the UFO phenomena. The second is all over the place.
Yes, very much all over the place. In fact, it was so all over the place we had to sort of make that a virtue. So it's a collection of essays rather than one coherent whole. But it was, yes, all over the place is a good way to describe it.
All right. So I figure with the three of us here, in this hour, we should easily be able to figure out the entire UFO enigma.
Oh, clearly. Yeah.
You know, it's got to be simple. With the three of us working on it, you know. Actually, that was something that Patrick Harper had said when I talked to him, is that when he first started investigating UFOs, he was like, well, this is interesting. If I put my mind to it, it shouldn't take me more than a week. And then he's like, and here I am 30 years later.
And everyone has that story. Yeah, everyone has that same story of stepping into this thinking like, oh, you know, this will be something I can do for a little while, and then realizing that it there's an aspect to it that does take over lives.
Yes. Yes. Even looking at it from the scholarly historical point of view, even with the Contact ebook, which grew out of my you know, history master's thesis, no matter how deeply I got into it, there was always more. There were always more stories. There were always more documents. There was always more weirdness that somehow connected to some aspect of it. And you have to be very sort of disciplined, depending on what sort of book or thing you're writing, very disciplined about where you draw the line and say, okay, look, I've got to narrow this down. I've got to be concise and you know, realistic about what I can investigate without it becoming too speculative or becoming, you know, ahistorical or like not scholarly like the book you're supposed to be writing, but this sort of free form, well, what if all this stuff is kind of true, which isn't really what I was supposed to be doing. So in a lot of ways, the Chaos Conundrum book was sort of a I've got all this pent-up paranormal weirdness in my head from all my other sort of history research, and I've got to put it somewhere. And even that, there's just so much more depth to go into on all of these topics.
Yeah.
And the problem is, it's not a, you know, this kind of oh, if you only read the New York Times and try to make your mind up about, you know, UFOs, you would think like, well, there's no information, there's no data, there's right. no, there's nothing out there, and that's the right. furthest thing from the truth. It's your, it's the amount of data, the amount of reports, the amount of information, especially now with the advent of the internet, is mind-boggling. It's crushing. It's there's too much data. You're buried in it.
Yeah.
Obviously, some of it is, you know, it's very, you know, the role of the investigator or the researcher is to, you know, sift through what may or may not be credible. But you know, there's certainly no lack of data, including yeah. you know, people that have never, you know, I talk to people all the time that have never, you know, filed a form. They've never put a thing into MUFON. They've never called the sheriff's department.
Right.
And
right.
yeah, so there's that end of it too.
Well, they don't want to be ridiculed.
Or there's actually, there's like, I mean, who do you call?
True.
You know, I mean, and really, who do you call?
Yeah, I think now there's still the National UFO Reporting Center, the hotline that the one guy whose name I can never remember runs. Davenport?
Peter Davenport.
Yeah,
yes.
Peter Davenport, yeah. And so there's that. But if you don't already know about that, I'm not sure how you'd go about finding it. It's sort of one of those, if you know who to call about UFOs, you know who to call. But if you're just somebody out there driving around at night and you see this, you know, remarkably bizarre thing in the sky, the first thing you might think is, well, the police, the Air Force, the FBI, and then you're sort of senses of, I'm not sure I want to talk to the cops about this for one reason or another kicks in, and so things do go unreported.
And from where I'm at right now, I'm like actually not at all interested. Like, you know, like actually I'm trying to write up this essay and it comes up just so bitter in a way that I'm going to have to put it back, put it away and like, okay, let's chill a little bit and I'll come back to this later. But, you know, the thought is that like, I don't really care about UFOs anymore. I don't really care about the lights in the sky. I've kind of moved past that. And I think it's a disservice to the you know, the grander weirdness to get all myopic about
oh, yeah.
these little things in the sky, because, you know, people are reporting stuff and it goes way beyond just, you know, what would be the pop culture version of the abduction thing
yeah.
where someone gets taken on a lonely road. I mean, it goes so far beyond that. It is so incredibly weird. And there's, you know, almost no resources for the folks that are having these experiences.
Yeah.
And this, yeah, and some of them are so challenging to try to make sense of.
Right, and very often they're deeply, deeply personal experiences, and they're experiences that even if you were to find somebody who would be a good person to tell about this experience, I'm not sure how well it would translate from the experiencer to the person taking the report. A light in the sky, you know, the old cliched light in the sky or flying saucers. I mean, you can. You know, we have a context for things flying around, but some of the more, you know, esoteric, ethereal weirdness that's out there, you try to describe it, and words are inadequate to the experience sometimes, I think.
Yeah.
And so even the act of reporting changes, you know, sort of creates a different sort of experience, if that makes sense. It doesn't translate well sometimes.
And the thing about lights in the sky nowadays is with all our technology, with all our secret craft, with all our remote drones and toys and everything else, it's so hard to know whether you're seeing something truly anomalous. Whereas if you go back 100 years and something is flying around in the sky and is gigantic, well, that's definitely anomalous.
Right, right. So,
you know,
exactly, and just the advent of drones and things like that, which don't fly in any conventional way,
yeah.
You know, these little helicopter propeller drones, you know, those could look genuinely unusual, and standing on the ground and pointing up in the air, and you would see something, and yes, agreed, you would, it might look alien, though it, you know, it just, it's made of conventional, you know, it was made in some lab in some military, you know, a place somewhere, and that could, you know, so there's a point when you have to sort of juggle that with what may or may not be, you know, happening on a grander
right.
scale.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I liked how Jacques Vallée's, I think it was his latest book, where he went and cataloged all the non-modern cases of UFO sightings.
Oh yeah. Yeah, Wonders in the Sky is that the name of it? Yeah, that was fascinating. To my campus library, I saw it on the new bookshelf when it came out, and I was, you know, kind of, I was in the middle of writing about this kind of stuff at the time, and I was like, well, that, you know, one of those nice little synchronicities that I didn't even know the book had come out, and there it is, you know, in the course of my workday. You know, I sort of stumble across it. It was just fascinating. I mean, not a lot of interpretation, not a lot of sort of, you know, ruminating on what it might mean, but just a very good, very clear cataloging of an enormous array, an enormous spectrum of strange things in the sky back before the, you know, the so-called modern UFO era began in 47. I think it's a great reference book, and I really need to get my own copy because I keep, you know, having it be overdue at the library when I'm looking at it. So.
And Chris Aubeck, the co-author of that book, and I'm not sure if he talks about this in the book or not, and he's very cautious the way he phrases it, and he's very prudent and logical and doesn't exaggerate or anything like that. My sense is he's not exaggerating. And my sense, he's kind of so cautious he's holding back, but he describes his UFO sighting that sent him on this this quest, in a way, you know, that sort of started him looking into this. And I think he was in Spain at the time. Mm. And he had the thought, it would be interesting to see a UFO. And I think it was within minutes he saw a UFO. Now, that doesn't really count as synchronicity in a way. That almost counts as premonition or, you know. But so that is actually what I'm finding more often than not, is that there is a deeply personal side to this where that is actually quite normal. I have talked to a lot of people, and I'll ask them, what were you thinking right before you saw the UFO? And they'll say, well, curiously enough, I was thinking, I want to see a UFO.
I've actually caught myself like forcibly not thinking I wish I could see a UFO just because I really don't want to see one. I'm kind of scared. So, you know, I'm driving around at night, you know, and you know, when these summer nights when you got the car windows open and everything, you're like, hey, I wonder if, don't see anything, just get home. But you know, as far as that goes, whether it's premonition or I've often wondered reading some of these accounts where, you know, you talk to the witness and, well, what were you thinking about? Well, what if we were to see a UFO out here? Is it a premonition, or is it somehow are certain people conjuring what they're seeing? So, you know, it, six of one, half dozen of the other. Could be either, or it could be a little bit of both, depending on how time works, you know. But are you predicting it, or are you remembering something that hasn't happened yet? There's a couple different ways that this could be working out, but there's clearly a connection between what people see and what's going on in their mind in the time period, you know, before that occurs. I've like Mike has, I've just seen and read a lot of stories like that.
And Stephen Greer, Dr. Stephen Greer, who I consider kind of a clown in this theater, he is doing night watches or sky watches where he vectors in. He says he vectors in the alien craft, you know. And I have no doubt that you get a group of people together with a charismatic, ringleader in a way to get everyone focused. And I have no doubt that the group intention, there's power in that, and that people will see stuff. And I've talked to people who've been on those tours, and it's kind of hit or miss, but some people say they see genuinely anomalous stuff in the sky. So that does, you know, that does not surprise me. It is, you know, the way he frames it is a little tiresome, I think.
Yeah. Well, what surprises me about him is that he can still, after those experiences, still look at it as a nuts and bolts extraterrestrial type of an experience.
Yeah, that's what I was just going to say, that, you know, it doesn't surprise me that people have seen things when they're on these sky watches with Greer, because he's been doing this, as far as I know, back in the mid-90s. Yeah. He was doing this when it was the C-SETI organization.
Yep.
And if there wasn't, there weren't a goodly number of people who were able to talk to other people and say, hey, I saw some weird stuff when I was out there with the flashlights on the hill with Dr. Greer, it would have, you know, been laughed off long ago, one would think. I always sort of wonder, you know, what these people are seeing on these sky watches with Greer. I'm sure they're seeing something. I'm just not sure they are seeing what they think they're seeing.
Oh, that could be too.
I'm sure they're seeing something, but I wonder if it's a lot more strange than the aliens in their structured flying saucers responding to the lights. But Greer never really, like you said, he's still seen as a nuts and bolts guy. He doesn't go in as weird a directions, as weird of directions as he might.
I saw him speak, you know, which was actually kind of amazing, I got to say. I saw him speak at a UFO conference a few years ago, and he showed a bunch of video footage, and it was that, infrared night vision where it had kind of the green glow around everything. And there was some stuff that was pretty interesting. You know, some of it was just little dots in the sky, and I cannot get excited about little teeny dots in the sky. there might be something up there, or it might be some, you know, I mean, there's so much theater involved in this, you know. Is it actually a little craft that's flying around with a little pilot, you know, in a little driver's seat up there, or is it some sort of little, you know, plasma electromagnetic just little blip of energy that's moving around, quite possibly for reasons just to baffle the people on the ground with the infrared glasses. But so he would there would be this little teeny dot in the sky, you know, and it would kind of flitter a little bit, and then it would come across, and Dr. Greer would say, "Oh, well, now there's the mothership, and you can see it's actually entering our dimension, and it is, you know, it's the beam ship or whatever he would call it. The beam ship is, and we're vectoring it in. It is, you know, you can see it entering our dimension. It's coming through a wormhole. You can see it right there, and it looks like a little. It's video, right? So it just looks like a little dot that kind of just turns on and then kind of collides across the sky and turns off. I mean, it doesn't look like it's interesting. I grant that it's interesting, but he, and this is human nature probably in a way too, that people are very quick to see a little dot in the sky and call it a ship or a craft.
Right. Yeah,
I don't know what it is, but it is. I think it's safe to say it's a little dot in the sky.
Yeah, they impose their views on it. I always remember back in, it was 94, 95. I remember it was one of the first issues of UFO magazine I ever bought, and they had an interview with one of the more one of the UFO people was more on the channeler. You know, Ashtar sort of new age fringe. And it was, I forget her name, but it was a blonde woman. And she was standing near Mount Shasta, of course, in California. And she was pointing at the sky. And she said, and the caption said, so-and-so points out the mothership hovering over Mount Shasta. And I'm looking at this and I'm like, that's a cloud. it's a cloud. It's not even ship shaped. It's a cloud. And I read the article and she says in a remark. I swear this was real. The explanation was it's a remarkable coincidence, but their motherships look a lot like our clouds. You know, and I'm reading this and I was like, that's no. Nobody's going to believe this unless they already believe it. It's just a cloud. And I got very, very frustrated by it before I just realized, wait, what's interesting to me is the fact that they're talking about this thing as though it's real and it has meaning for them. And what meaning does it have? And what does that say about our society and our culture, et cetera? But I'll never forget that just my sort of indignant yelling at the page in an empty room. It's a cloud. You know, so I just got very worked up.
But you know, it would be a great technology to be able to disguise your ship as a cloud.
Oh yeah, that would be. I mean, the Air Force would kill for something like that. It would be wonderful. You know, just sort of, you know, beyond stealth or cloaking technology, which is, we're just a cloud, friendly little cloud, as the art guy said. You know, friendly lookout cloud up in the sky. You know, we're not targeting anything. We're just a cloud. That would be wonderful. Just wonderful.
And I always make an effort to go and, you know, at conventions and people I contact or talk on the phone with, you know, some people will have, I'm judgmental in my own way, and they'll say things that kind of make my toes curl in my shoes, you know, like the fact that, you know, like, oh, here I'm pointing to a cloud and it's just, and I'm saying that it's some sort of mothership. Mm-hmm. But, you know, oftentimes I've spoken with those folks, you know, or people with that kind of, you know, what I consider lack of critical thought. And, you know, they'll tell some stories that will sound, I mean, you know, so I don't doubt that some of those folks have had very real experiences where they have interacted with something enormously strange. And You know, I don't know whether this is a byproduct or a symptom or you know, a cause and effect, where the actual act of confronting this stuff will shatter your ability to think rationally. You know, that may sound judgmental, but it's, you know, the folks that have the weirdest stories, I'm always want to sit down and talk to them. Right. And, you know, they'll say some things that are like, ooh, you know, like that's crossed the line for me. I'm polite and I nod and I listen. And then they'll tell other things that are just, that aren't widely publicized, you know, like the things that they'll describe firsthand that I've heard but have never read anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I find it interesting that John Keel and now more recently Brad Steiger has come out to point out that the similarities between like channeled information and the information the contactees got and the modern UFO information that's coming through all kind of has the same feel to it, some of the same names, it's like it's coming from the same source, even though it's completely different.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I did in the Extraterrestrials in the American Zeitgeist book is I took the contactee stuff and I sort of traced the same themes through the channelers of the 70s and into some aspects of the exopolitics movement. And I do it in a very sort of material way, materialistic way as opposed to a esoteric way, just mostly because of the nature of the book and also because it kind of made sense to me. But sort of the idea of a being like Ashtar, or Ashtar Command, that George Van Tassel introduces that Ashtar name and that persona back in the 1950s, and Tuella, the channeler, sort of in the 70s and 80s brings that keeps going with that idea, and then in the 1990s and into the year 2000, guy Michael Ejelian, I think his name is, in a book called Prepare for Contact or something like that, keeps these names going, Ashtar and all those other guys. And the way I sort of examine it is not so much, you know, these are messages from the same source, but rather this is one aspect of it. One way you could look at it is, and it's an attempt at branding a certain cosmological viewpoint. Well, what are these people all about? If I read this book, what's it about? You see Ashtar. You see the name Ashtar. You see Ashtar Command, and you go into a certain mind space where you're like, oh, I know about Ashtar. That's, you know, peace and love. They're you're acting as guardians for our planet against the bad guys, and so on and so on. So there's some aspects of it that are branding. But as far as any sort of real experiences that these people might have had, it might also indicate, in sort of a less academic, cynical way, it might also indicate some sort of shared experience at the root of all of these things.
Hmm. Okay. I've noticed a slow curve as of late of more and more people investigating UFOs who are coming out into the away from the nuts and bolts idea into the idea that this is something not necessarily extraterrestrial. Like years ago, that was unthinkable. When Whitley Strieber suggested it after writing Communion, he got blackballed from, you know, UFO conventions and stuff. But now it seems to be more and more acceptable. What do you think has changed that's made that the case?
You know, one thing is just science fiction and popular, you know, the stuff on TV. I mean, there's so much trippy, weird stuff on you know, every single sci-fi TV show is, you know, everyone is, you know, flitting in and out between dimensions and, you know, jumping through time and stuff like that. So, and I think that comes from, you know, I think the script writers are sitting down and like, for example, the script writers at the X-Files, you know, they were very open about having, you know, a room with all kinds of UFO books in it. And the script writers would go in there and kind of, you know, leaf through these books and see if they could find a cool plot point. So, you know, that's one thing, you know, from, you know, video games on up is creating a new updated version of... well, not even updated. In a sense, it's going. It's a throwback to, you know, the realms of the gods or something like that. You know, so. But it is, you know, on another level, I think it's happening one funeral at a time, where just the old crotchety guys that you know, men, I'll say that are trying to make sense of this stuff, never stepped beyond, you know, this is a physical metal thing piloted by, you know, people in essence just like us. They're little scientists. They're flying in a craft. They're coming here to visit. They're coming here to do exactly what we would do if we went to another planet, and it, they never go beyond that.
Yeah, I agree. The idea of the fantastical is no longer really fantastic, and it is a throwback to the land of the gods and you know fairyland and things like that. I think it's also in the pop culture, at least. I think the outer space flying saucer aspect of it has been kind of played out. If I'm looking at it from a TV producer or a writer's point of view, it's a throwback, but not a far enough throwback to be cool and retro. It's just, oh gosh, flying saucers and aliens. We've done that. Everybody's done that. What else do you got? Well, there's these different dimensions, and we've got these physicists talking about string theory and parallel dimensions and universes and things. Well, that sounds a little fresher. Let's go with that. So I think at a practical level, the outer space thing might be a little played out. But also, like Mike said, the landscape of ufology or paranormal studies is changing as well. There's more room for a lot more speculation, or at least taking more seriously the speculation about non-ET hypotheses that have been brought up and in previous generations were rejected.
Well, you figure Kiel and Vallée were really the first two to throw out the idea that these things weren't just extraterrestrial nuts and bolts crafts.
Yeah.
And they didn't care what anyone thought, you know, of their ideas. They just presented it because that's where it was leading them. But it really, I was really surprised to see Brad Steiger come out with his new book and say that, you know, he now believes it's all one phenomena, because he was always such a nuts and bolts guy back in the day. And you always had this antipathy between like the paranormal groups and the UFO groups and the Bigfoot groups. Like, there's no crossover. If you, you know, it's like, oh, UFOs are silly. I believe in ghosts. Well, I believe in UFOs and ghosts are silly. And now you're starting to see that, well, maybe there's a connection between all of these things that, you know, we need to understand to get to what's behind all of it.
Right. And the connections that they're looking for aren't, you know, back in the day, you might have some people saying, well, what if ghosts are really aliens? And it would be like, it wasn't really a merger, like unified field theory of the paranormal, like we're starting to see now. It was more like, well, these ghosts are popular. I'm going to co-opt them into my flying saucer worldview. I think what's going on now is more like what you said. It's maybe all of these things have the same source. And I think that's an exciting direction.
And there is a blurring. I mean, obviously, you know, the near-death experience is different than the alien abduction experience, there are so many odd overlaps, you know, and that goes into, you know, it's, you know, the ghost thing. And I know one guy who is very much a UFO abductee. I don't want to give his name. And he lives in a place in the Rockies, and near his town there are lots and lots of Bigfoot sightings. So he's actually seen a Bigfoot, and then he's very caught, you know, he'll talk about, you know, he has the classic stuff where, you know, he'll follow the tracks in the snow, and then they'll get out in a great big open meadow, and then poof, the tracks will just disappear. They'll just end. And it's just so funny that, you know, he kind of got into the Bigfoot, you know, not really Bigfoot hunting, but sort of Bigfoot research, you know, collecting reports. And it just, it's like, it just fascinates me. Like, he's a UFO abductee and he's getting into this and he's seeing it. You know, he's actually, it's the stuff is manifesting for him. And he's got this amazing sighting that he saw very close up. You know, he measured it at 90 feet, which is pretty freaking close.
Yeah.
You know, so he was in his car and it was at a tree, and then it, you know, was leaning against the tree, and, you know, so he had the exact height where his arm was touching the tree, and you know, so he could measure the height, and it was like 8 foot tall, and the fact that he has had so much ongoing paranormal stuff in his life, to me, says a lot.
You bring up near-death experiences in relation to UFOs, and one of the things I wanted to bring up with was Kenneth Ring's work on that, which was well ahead of its time. Back in the early 90s, he had done a comparison between people who had UFO experiences and the after effects on their lives, and the same with near-death experiences, and found that they were very similar. And it's not something he ever expected. He said going into it, he thought UFOs were ridiculous. until he read Communion and sat there and went, well, now, wait a minute, why are these things seemingly somewhat connected? Because it really, that doesn't make sense if you're thinking of UFOs as nuts and bolts and near-death experiences as what happens when you die. And maybe right. neither one of those are the case. Maybe near-death experiences are altered states, not necessarily what happens when we die. And the UFOs are part of that altered state experience.
Yeah, I mean, and that sort of thinking I find very, very, very interesting. And when you when people are confronted with that idea of this idea of altered states, the defense mechanism for people who are in, you know, the UFO camp or the near death experience camp or the alien camp or whatever, is to say, what you're saying, it's all in my head, and like something can be all in your head and be absolutely very real.
Right.
So I think these altered states, and you know, that brings us around to Terrence McKenna and speaking of altered states, and you know, some of his stuff about aliens and UFOs and his little machine elves is just fascinating. I think does really serve as a nexus point for some of these ideas, and I think that's a fruitful direction in which to go, because I think altered states could be sort of detectable and measurable, and I think for the people who sort of fetishize the science of these things, that might be a fruitful direction.
And if you've ever talked to a UFO abductee, they will describe their experience. You know, oftentimes it'll just be like a little fleeting little thing. They'll say like, oh, you know, there I was, you know, I remember driving late at night, but then I had this short little memory of being out of the car and walking down this, you know, thing, and there was a bright light. So there's no aliens in there. And so that, you know, but, you know, some people have the experience with the memories of, you know, onboard ship and aliens, and all of them will describe it in this way that is, you know, they'll use terms, they'll say it is more real than real. Mm-hmm. You know, they'll say things like, that's the real world. This world is the illusion.
And you get that from near-death experiences as well.
Yeah. And what's his name? Rick Strassman, who wrote the DMT book.
Right. Yeah.
You know, he actually had that line right in it, which I've heard so many times from UFO research, was, you know, it was more real than real. Or people will use the term hyper-vivid. You know, which are these strange words that define an altered reality. I have a story of a woman, this is my owl research, where she took a bunch of mushrooms. She's a practicing shaman. She had studied with folks in South America and Mexico, and then Native Americans in the Northwest. And, you know, she'd been using mushrooms to enter an altered state. And so the first time she ever does mushrooms alone, it's kind of a rite of passage in a way, you know, not to have the teacher there, or the guru, or now I guess the teacher would be the better, guru is not the right term, you know, to have the teacher right there. So she does mushrooms alone, and what appears to her is a giant white owl. And the owl gives her a message. And so this is the classic, you know, shaman's journey. You know, they're the ones, the intermediary between this world and that. And that is also, in a way, the role of the UFO abductee. They're coming back and they're saying things like, you know, oh, I sat and watched a view screen. I watched this three-dimensional view screen. And as I watched it, you know, like it was almost like I could smell things. I was transported into it. And I was shown, you know, ecological destruction, and I was shown, you know, the natural systems collapsing and tidal waves and you know, deserts growing where there used to be forests, and then they come back and tell that. I mean, that's in a way the same thing as the shaman taking mushrooms, getting a message from the great beyond, and then you know, telling their tribe.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, there are these sort of shared experiences, and I think, like you said, what the message for the tribe that the shaman receives, or the message from the space brothers, the contactee receives. There's very much an element that at least some aspect of these experiences is meant to be, you know, for want of a better term, broadcast to people. Whether it's for the good of a small number of people or for the entire human community, there's some aspect of it that goes beyond the personal to something that there's a message for maybe all of us, which I think gives these experiences a bit more weight as far as something that needs to be studied fairly seriously.
Joseph Campbell, I think it was in the Bill Moyers thing that he did, that miniseries. Mm-hmm. He said, he was asked, you know, he basically said the old myths are collapsing. You know, the old myths aren't functioning. The old myths were, you know, one tribe against another. You know, one village would have one myth. You'd go over the hill to the other village and they would have a different myth. And both of those myths serve the village. And he says those myths have all collapsed. They no longer function in the way the world is now. Mm-hmm. And Bill Moyers asks, you know, so what's the new myth? And Joseph Campbell says, I don't know what the new myth is any more than I'll know what tomorrow night's dream will be. But I do know the new myth will need to be a global myth and not a village myth. And as I watched that, I was just like, that's the UFO myth. That's the emerging myth. It's happening. It's happening in the form of the UFO phenomena. The new myth is welling up, you know, perhaps out of, you know, perhaps it, you know, very well might be metal spaceships out there doing something. But what is more interesting in a way is that this new myth, you know, is arising. So we can't really see ourselves until we see it reflected in the other in a way.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very, and what's important about that word myth and that concept of the mythic is that myths are, you know, stories and legends that sort of accrete and evolve and expand around a kernel of something that is, you know, absolutely often sort of hedging my bets there, but something that's true. And for those who are sort of stuck in this sort of yes, no, positive negative dichotomy, the concept of myth is, you know, usually reduced to I believe this lock, stock, and barrel versus none of this is absolutely false. This is it's a myth. It's a myth. That sort of derisive, dismissive thing. And the opposite of that is here's a myth and this is now my religion and I believe it because it's been revealed to me. And that's not, I think, the point of a myth. It's a story that binds together the tribe or the global tribe in this sense. And so the people who are sort of stuck in these Aristotelian yes, no, positive, negative wings of logic and rationality are going to be the ones who one, have the most trouble dealing with these new global myths or any myths as they emerge. And two, the ones who are going to be the most annoying to those of us who are exploring, you know, the meaning of these myths, because we're going to get, you know, stuck in the middle of this, you know, sort of shouting fight between it's true, it's false, it's true, it's false. So I think myth is the best way to describe a lot of this.
In John Mack's final book, Passport to the Cosmos, where he compares and contrasts the shamanic initiation to the UFO abduction lore, he talks to a bunch of shamans. And the shamans will say things like, you know, the spirit journey of the village shaman takes place, and then they enter this different realm, and then they fly with the eagles, and then Dr. Mack says, wait a minute, was that real, or was that like a dream realm? And then all this is, and he would ask this he kind of has listed a bunch in a row where different shamans will tell a very trippy story like that, you know, and he'll ask, you know, was this real? Did this really happen? And they'll all say, like almost dismissively, it doesn't matter if it's real. Mm. You know, yeah. That's not the point, that if it's real or not. And I think that, you know, Grant Cameron is a UFO researcher, and he had been doing a lot of research on presidential UFO issues, where he'd been going to the presidential libraries and stuff like that. And then he got into this consciousness thing where he got totally obsessed with it and totally absorbed with it. And he came up with this really interesting, brilliant stuff. And he makes a great presentation. I've seen his presentation on it. And I spoke with him, and he said, you know, ufology missed the boat. We totally missed this, you know, because we missed it. Ufology missed it. You know, here's this stuff about consciousness, and it's so relevant. It's just so important, and it ties everything together, and we totally missed it. And I interrupted him, and I'm like, you know, whoa, whoa, whoa. Like, you know, ufology didn't miss that. You know, like you got to talk to the people. I mean, that's what everyone, you know, there's the demarcation between the nuts and bolts and the love and light crowd. The love and light crowd, you know, they're mostly women with their flowy dresses and their, you know, giant turquoise earrings are telling stories that fit the consciousness aspect of it. And you go across the convention center and this, you know, the men with mustaches and, you know, like in military haircuts are all talking about, you know, the measuring the burn marks in the yard, you know, where the craft landed.
Yeah.
And he didn't even, in a way, he didn't acknowledge that this, that there's this other side. You know, like he basically stumbled on it and felt like he discovered it. And I was like, no, this has been part of ufology since, you know, the first report. It's just that, you know, it's that the, and I'm being very simplistic when I divide it into men and women, but that's a nice, you know, that's very clean and very, right. You know, it's a very guy-centric thing to not want to look at emotions. And it's a very feminine-centric thing. This is some horrible generalizations here. It's a very feminine-centric thing to want to ignore, like, you know, the mechanics of it.
Right, right. Well, we got to take a quick 45-second break. We'll be right back with Mike and Aaron.
Okay.
The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live guests via email or the live chat room. You can also check out our upcoming schedule, blog, link section, book reviews, videos, and links to our Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and much more. That's wheredidtheroadgo.com.
And tonight we've been talking with Mike Cleland and Aaron Gullius, and we've been discussing primarily the UFO phenomena on many different levels. And didn't mean to cut you guys off there.
No, that's fine.
That's fine. Now I just I can get on a roll sometimes. So,
there's a couple of different ways I wanted to go with this. I'm not sure which way to take it. Let's go further into the whole consciousness idea, DMT and all of that. It almost seems to me like sometimes when people see these lights could be, for instance, Paul Devereaux has shown the connection between Earth lights and UFO reports. And, you know, these things could have some level of consciousness themselves, or maybe whatever's causing the lights is also creating a DMT release in the people viewing it. Maybe the area that they're in that's, you know, whatever magnetic field is creating these plasmas, these earth lights, sets off DMT in a person, and they have an experience. And they connect that experience to the light when it's not technically connected to the light. The light is also just an after effect of the same thing that's setting off their experience.
Oh.
Yeah, I followed this kind of a little bit, you know, that so the thing that is interesting and that is very rarely reported on, and it's filling up my inbox, these kind of stories, are these deeply personal experiences. These experiences that play out like specifically tailored to the individual.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't think that when the helicopter flies into Yellowstone National Park to dart the bears, you know, the bears are having a deeply personal experience. It may be unfolding like that. So that is playing out. So, and I wish I could give a good example. The only examples I could give would take a half hour to tell.
And I think that the fact that the examples do take a half hour to tell is very telling of the types of experience, or the what might be going on at the heart of this. This is something that is much more complex than simply seeing something in the sky that is there and nobody saw it but the one person who reported it, or only one person thinks to report it. I think there is some aspect of this, and this goes back to the DMT thing, that is coming from within us in some way. Or there is something within us that's connecting with something outside of us. To be all sort of goofy about it, is connecting to something that's in the space between us and what's outside us. I hate this word because it's pretentious, but the liminal space between us and that which is outside us. I'm reading a whole bunch of cultural criticism stuff for a project right now, and if I see the phrase liminal space one more time, I'm going to go nuts. But it's the only word that works sometimes.
But it is interesting that paranormal stuff, UFO stuff, all does tend to take place, you know, is drawn to these liminal areas in our existence.
Yeah.
And that really doesn't make sense if you're, again, dealing with a nuts and bolts type of thing.
Yeah, I agree. And I think if anybody out there is wondering, you know, sort of what we're talking about with liminal spaces, if you haven't read it, George Hansen's book, yes, The Trickster and the Paranormal, is just an amazingly brilliant exploration of the trickster phenomenon, which is sort of an anthropological concept in a variety of cultures, and how that relates to paranormal phenomena, not just UFOs, but particularly ESP, psi phenomenon, things like that. Yeah. It's an amazing book, and I believe it's still in print and still available, and everybody should go read it.
Although it is not an easy read.
I have it online. And on my Kindle. I got it. It was like it was cheap to get. It's a big fat book. So I got it, and it was. It's not the kind of thing like, hey, let me just open this up and just glance at it and kind of.
No.
Each time I've tried to dig into it, it's like a little bit like, oh gosh, this is. But it's very interesting. Oh, here I have an example of, and this is interesting. There's a guy, his name is Brian. He has I feel so bad that I can't remember the name of his website, but it is Liminal is right in the name of his website. And he told a story, and he's a really good writer. It's a really interesting website because this is actually one of the better, you know, there's this kind of this thing that I'm finding it's not so cut and dry. It's not so easy to put someone in the cookie cutter box of abductee, you know. And I need another word to describe the people who are, you know, have some of the stories to share. Maybe they're an abductee. Maybe it's like something different that's happened, but it seems to fit some of the checklist of the abductee. So I've been using the term the maybe people. It's an imperfect term. I don't really like it. I wish I had another one. But so he would fall into that maybe category. Perhaps if a UFO researcher sat with him for, you know, some months and did a lot of research, you could make a stronger, label, I guess. It's a horrible way to say it. But he had a story of he saw this UFO, and it was like, he drew it, and it was very weirdly shaped. It was kind of flat on the bottom and then kind of scalloped like on the top. And he saw it for a while. And then he was at Starbucks, and he saw the little cookies. They're called Madeline cookies.
Oh.
And he said, that's it. That's exactly what I saw. That's what I saw. Basically saw a flying Madeline cookie. And he later found out that Proust in... Remembrance of Things Past, is that the name of the book, which I've never read?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds
so. So if Proust wrote a book, I think it's called Remembrance of Things Past, and it's this trilogy of books. And this guy goes through this sort of trippy reliving of his entire life as an old man, and it happens when he bites a Madeleine cake. And this guy Brian told me this was so perfect. Like he's totally into beautiful writing, and when he realized that this was this kind of epic of modern Western literature, you know, trippy beautiful writing, which is what he's trying to do in a way in his own writing, so he sees a UFO shaped like a Madeleine cake, and the Madeleine cake is the trigger for this, you know, this trippy reliving of someone's life. So he then told me, like, he felt so strongly in this total sense of knowing that whatever he saw was theatrically projecting itself as a Madeleine cake. So he would go through the steps to try to solve the mystery. And he felt like it was specifically tailored to him, and his website has Liminal in it.
The Hansen's book, I mean, I had him on early on. I plan on having him back, but I want to try and reread the book. But the problem with rereading the book at all is it seemed to me like I could read one chapter at a time.
Yeah.
And then I had to wait and let my brain absorb what he just said. And when I was talking to him, he said he had a hard time writing it for the very same reason. Like to wrap your brain around the whole concept of liminality and the trickster is so subtle and so different from what we're used to, but yet it's so... It makes so much sense at the same time.
Yeah. When I read the book, the only reason I even knew it existed was I sent an email to Vicki Ecker when she was running UFO Magazine, and I said, I saw you're looking for book reviewers. And she said, okay, I'll send you one. And she sent me The Trickster and the Paranormal to review for UFO Magazine. and that was an incredibly difficult job, to get the essence of that book into an article that would appeal to the people who read UFO Magazine, which I mean, it was a great magazine. Haven't read it in a while, but I assume it's still probably pretty good. But it never really delved into the sort of things that Hansen talks about, this you know, paranormal stuff that draws its sort of essence. His argument draws from a lot of cultural theory and anthropology, and as well as the general paranormal stuff. It is a very, very difficult book to read. I had to have a couple other books sitting next to me so I could look things up that he was talking about, so I made sure I understood them while I was reading his book. Mm. So it was it's a difficult read, but it does sort of this idea of the trickster, that something about the phenomenon is playing with us as we're experiencing the phenomenon, whether in a malevolent way or in a benign way, sort of goes back to the cookie thing that Mike was talking about. You know, this picks out something about the experiencer and uses that to draw them in and to sort of engage them. And that indicates at least some sort of type of intelligence behind whatever these phenomena or this one massive sort of uber phenomenon might be.
And I just looked up online here. He does not have liminal in the name of his website. His website is called Numinous Intrusions.
Oh,
and
Numinous.
It's really great. Numinous and liminal, I mean, those are kind of synonyms, aren't they?
Yeah, they're sort of in the same sort of branch of the whole sort of between meanings, without meanings, sort of vague, fuzzy meanings, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and he's a great writer, and it's really engaging stuff, and he doesn't post very often, but when he does, it's interesting.
Hmm. All right. I just lost what I was going to say. The trickster concept, you know, Jacques Vallée deals with that a little bit in Dimensions. He calls it metalogic. Mm-hmm. And it's so hard to understand why that would be a part of the whole phenomenon. And it always left me with the idea that either our consciousness is much bigger than we understand, or that there is another consciousness interfacing with ours, or maybe a little bit of both.
I like the idea that it's another consciousness interfacing with ours. Keel wrote about this, and one of his books is called Our Haunted Planet. And I love that notion that we're sharing the planet with something, or sharing reality with something that is like us enough to engage us in these experiences, but different enough that we simply are not able currently to fully comprehend what it might be, whether it's a natural part of the world or something sort of outside it that came to reside here, sort of speculating about that whole sort of thing there. But I've got no evidence one way or the other. But it's an interesting thing to think about, that there might be something sort of vague and I love the word numinous out there, that's, you know, for want of a better term, messing with us for reasons that we can't always understand.
Well, it definitely has a sense of humor, whatever it is.
Yes.
Yeah, and it is very, and I think these puzzles are set up to be unsolvable.
Hmm.
You know, I think it's, you know, there's, it's a, it's almost like, you know, the labyrinth that you get drawn into is a maze without an exit in a way. And I just think of my own experiences with owls, and that is, you know, that was my way into this, was the owl sightings. That was the, in a way, the proof. You know, I went through a phase starting in around 2006 to about 2009 where I saw so many owls under such weird, heightened, emotional, you know, prescient moments that it freaked me out. I was totally flipped out. But it forced me to, in a way, to look at reality in a totally different way. So in a way, I was presented with a mystery a mystery. I don't plan on solving, but I can poke at the edges of it and kind of marvel at the mystery. And so, yes, so this, from my direct experience, it, you know, manifested in the form of owls. And now I'm this, you know, nerdy guy that's, you know, sort of stuck with the owl thing at this point.
Okay.
Yeah. I think we all get drawn in by something and then get stuck with it. And like you end up being the owl guy and I end up being the contactee guy, people have referred to me as. And we're all drawn in by something that speaks to us in some way, even if we can't fully verbalize what that is or how it does it. I think even if you're looking at this and attempting to look at these things in an objective way, not as an experiencer, but as an observer of experiencers, there's something almost compulsive about it that's kind of frightening. I try to get out, and it's something about it draws me back in. And maybe because there are just so many stories left to figure out and to understand and to read and to hear, but there's something about it that definitely has an attractive force.
And it is very consistent to hear this over and over again, where people get into this and then just get so obsessed.
Yeah. And it, you know, obviously it's been detailed from various people how this can totally ruin people's lives as well.
Yes.
And Whitley Strieber was a great example. I mean, however he's doing now, it tore his life apart.
Yeah.
So if he was faking the whole thing, it was a really bad decision.
Yeah, that was, and to you know, he basically, you know, had a, you know, made $1 million off of the book, and then everything crumbled around him. Yeah.
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 And so you would think if he was faking it, he would have just given it up and gone a different direction.
Yeah, I think at one point it might have said, you know, he might have said, well, you know what, this scam did not work out. You know, that I got the big payoff for communion, but now it's all gone to hell. I got to just get out.
Yeah.
But he sort of doubled down on it. You know, year after year, his stuff became much more, much more focused on a lot of the weirder aspects of these things. If people out there, you know, follow the links on the website and read Mike's essay about the owls that's out there, he has a response to some of his owl ideas from Whitley Strieber that is just amazing and somewhat strange. I mean, you read it and you're like, well, there's something odd here, about how the grays come in threes and there's connections to, they're connected to God in a way we aren't, and some stuff that is very Whitley Strieber-ish, but it's also not commercial at all. No. I think if for Strieber this was some sort of, you know, way to make money, he's going about it in the worst way possible, because you know, there's not a lot of commercial appeal to some of the more esoteric things he says. I think he's definitely a guy who is, you know, clearly experienced something and is continuing to work through it in ways that he thinks can benefit him and benefit others.
Yeah, that quote was interesting because, and he used to do it on his website. I'm not sure if he's doing it anymore, but he would have kind of a group chat on Wednesday nights. And I would go a few times. I would log in and get onto his site and go to the thing, and people would ask him questions, and he would answer in that kind of Zen Cohen way. And I think he just does that. I think, like, when he, like, you know, goes to the, you know, drugstore and asks which is the best chapstick, I'm sure he asks it in this Zen Cohen way, you know. And I just think that's the way he is. And, you know, so yeah, I actually contacted him because I said I was going to put that quote in the thing. And I said, okay, now my sense is that you just jotted this off. You read this article, you went to the comments, wham, you jotted this thing off and you just moved on. And I can't remember how I phrased it, because it did, you know, I wanted to make sure that, you know, I framed it right, because that was my sense. Mm-hmm. And as opposed to something that he had, you know, deliberated on and meditated over and, you know, come to this lofty conclusion. And he said, no, I just jotted that out and just zipped it off.
Yeah, it's because I read it, it's like that's very profound. So to hear that it was just sort of an off the cuff, you know, response, that's pretty amazing. I think you're right. That must just sort of be the way his mind and his words function, in that very sort of esoteric yet concise way.
And that's the reason that he's such an easy target, in my opinion, by you know, the people who want to point a finger to at him and say he's lying, just because he's such a beautiful writer that it's disarming in a way. It's like it's too artful the way he's describing his firsthand experiences.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, it's poetic, and it doesn't lend itself to sort of scientific rational analysis. There's a poetry to it that makes, I can see making people think, well, this is just a story. This is just made up. He's you know, latched onto this sort of zeitgeist of the aliens, and now he's sort of spinning his tales about it. But it's definitely an artful way that he does this that I think it does set him up for criticism, or has set him up for criticism over the years. I can see.
And
that.
It's the, you know, the, I'm going to go right back to the UFO conference, and the women in their flowy dresses and turquoise earrings are on one side of the conference hall, and the men with their mustaches and their clipboards with all kinds of data about, you know, radar sightings and things like that. You know, it is very difficult for that logical, pragmatic guy mentality to latch on to that poetry. And it's very easy for the women. And I'm obviously, once again, generalizing in a way that's way oversimplistic, but you get what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's probably why he got so much heat from the general male oriented UFO community.
And was so sort of seen as a savior in a way when he came out with that book from the, you know, the Love and Light. Well, yeah. And his stuff is not necessarily Love and Light, but, you know, so much more, you know, a poetic look at these mysteries. You know, that book is amazing. I just read it recently again, and I was blown away by how that book is 25 years old.
It is, yes.
And it's still completely relevant.
Yep.
And even more, I mean, it's like the rest of the UFO community hasn't even got caught up to it yet.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. And Transformation was just as deep of a book following that up.
Yeah.
Yes, I agree.
So, I mean, the only thing he ever wrote that really kind of threw me a little was The Key, which he claims,
I love that book. I love that book.
It sat weird with me. Like, I almost wonder if he was if it was kind of a trickster sort of apparition to him.
You know, it's at the time that I read The Key, I was reading all kinds of channeled books. This would have been in the late 90s. And it just, it had the vibe of a channeled book. You know, it was the question and answer kind of format. And so I just, I mean, it just like, it just, in essence, it went in the pile with channeled books. And I've asked him, you know, straight up, you know, like, do you think that was a channeled book? And he's like, oh, no. And which is great, which is exactly what the shaman would say. You know, does it have to be real or does it have to not be real? You know, and it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You know, the information in that is really valid, I think. I don't necessarily agree with all the nuanced points of it. And it's hard to know whether he was, you know, he talked about the process of that was afterwards he, you know, he had this notes that he made on a yellow legal pad. Mm-hmm. And then he went through sort of, he would meditate over these things and then write. So, you know, obviously he was, you know, he was putting himself into it in a way that is, you know, I mean, whatever. If you take the story literally, he would have to do that because I don't think anyone could remember a 45-minute conversation word for word.
Yeah, it wasn't a transcript. It was...
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
It was his interpretation of a you know, as best as he could do.
And someone had written an article, too, dealing with The Key, showing that some of the stuff in The Key came almost directly out of Talbot's holographic universe, and that was something that Strieber was very aware of.
Yes, he's a big fan of Michael Talbot's holographic universe, yeah.
And so some of it was taken, like, almost line for line out of the holographic universe, so that says, did it come out of his subconscious? I don't think he would have done it intentionally.
Right.
No, he's a smart enough writer to mix it up at least.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. So that's just kind of a weird sort of thing where it makes you wonder how did that get in there like that? And then he came out and said that the actual book that was published was not what he sent off to the publisher.
Right.
And that had been updated. There's a new version that came out probably 2 or 3 years ago. An updated version has a new foreword and a new afterword. And there were some things from the transcript that never made it you know, or that were switched. A few keywords were switched. And yeah, so
subtle
who knows?
Things.
Trickster, yeah. And it just, yeah. One or two words would change the entire meaning of a whole line of thought.
Yeah, I found that very interesting that I listened to the Unknown Country episode where he discussed that. And I just found that fascinating that, you know, that if somebody was going to make changes, the type of changes they made between these editions of it or however it worked were the types of changes that come from being intimately familiar with the work. It's not just, haha, I'm going to leave this chapter out. It was something much more subtle than that. So I thought that was one of the most fascinating things about it. Not just that, you know, he alleged that it had been changed, but it had been changed in a way that indicated a deep familiarity with the subject.
Yeah, yeah. It was definitely a weird. I mean, just reading the whole account of it was just very strange. Because, like I said, I don't get the feeling that Struber is in any way dishonest.
No,
but
you know, I don't. I mean, he's also. And he's also a very good storyteller, which, you know, in a way is exactly what I was saying before, that in a way works against him.
True, true. You're on WVBR FM, Ithaca. This is Where Did the Road Go? And we're going to talk a few more minutes with Mike and Aaron here as we're discussing different aspects of the UFO phenomena. One of the things I wanted to get back to a little bit was Kenneth Ring's work. And one of the things he found in doing his study between near-death experiences and UFO encounters was that there was a personality type that was more likely to have this experience. And it was, I think he called it encounter-prone personality, I think he called it. And it doesn't discount that these people are having these experiences, but maybe that they're more able to have these experiences. Maybe they have more DMT in their system, for instance, or they have something that allows them to tune into this other reality that these things are coming through, you know, and meet it halfway, whereas other people don't. You know, the same way that someone could be standing there and one person sees a ghost and the other doesn't. I had some very strange experiences where two people, me and someone else, saw this really profound thing happening and the other person standing there did not at all.
Yeah.
And it makes you wonder what's really going on. Like what aspect of reality is that affecting? Like, is it a DMT thing, or is it a tuning thing, or is it just like some people are colorblind and other people aren't? Any thoughts?
No. Here, let me just say, because I haven't read Kenneth Ring's book. It's on the shelf here, but I've read interviews with him. Now he's saying also, if I'm getting this correctly, that not only that the UFO contactee or abductee has this encounter prone personality. It's also the people who are having the near-death experience.
Right.
Okay, that's what I thought, because I've heard him say that, and I've always wondered. I've never followed up on that. Yes, that is very, very interesting, and that is where, I mean, there's all these odd little things that show up in the, I'm just going to go straight from the abduction research, because I can't really speak much to the near-death experience research. There's two things. There's the stuff that leading up to it, and then there's the stuff afterwards. You know, and both of them are similar, including synchronicities. Afterwards, people tend to be synchronicity prone, which is fascinating to me. And then on one level, this is something that hasn't been researched in much depth, but I think it's 15% of the population worldwide has a Rh negative blood type.
Mm-hmm.
So 15% of the population has Rh negative blood type. And I think it's 75% of the people, this is very difficult I don't trust these numbers exactly,
but the way
the research is, which is minimal so far, says about 75% of the people who have had UFO experiences, UFO contact abduction experiences, are Rh negative.
Huh.
50% of the overall population, 75% of the abductees. If it should be 15, right? It should, if these aliens are just flying around their UFOs and looking out their window saying, you know, there's one, get them. It should, you know, it. So the implication is that the Rh factor is somehow important to the way they they are choosing, or, you know, it's once again, you know, where is it, there's the, you know, what's happening in which direction, you know, are they choosing us, or is it the consciousness is merging somehow? But yeah, so that one little point I think is interesting.
That is interesting, because it does sort of, what that says to me is that a fruitful avenue for exploration would be something sort of internal, maybe chemical, you know, within the brain. Is there something about the body chemistry that the Rh negative blood type would have more, not necessarily be the only factor that determines what people experience or if they experience something, but a, you know, significant contributing factor. So again, it's a much like what Ring has done with some of his research. There are ways that we can use scientific means to look at some of this stuff, and not get the whole story, but get maybe a way to delve into it, more clearly. Just from what little I know about Ring's work, what I think is very interesting, at least from the near death side of it, is that his, if I'm remembering this interview with him correctly, he said there's no common thread of what people believe about the afterlife that affects who has the near-death experiences. Yeah. People who have no belief in the afterlife have similar near-death experiences to somebody who has a very sort of orthodox Christian belief in the sort of traditional, you know, angels and green fields vision, yeah, of the afterlife. So it's something that's a common experience for those who experience it, and it happens regardless of what their preconceived notions about what the moment of death is like, depending on their beliefs. So I think that's significant as well, because there are, you know, while there are a lot of, you know, tales of contactees or abductees who have pre-existing beliefs about those things, there are also stories about people who don't know how to interpret, who don't have a sort of pop cultural or pre-existing framework for these paranormal experiences. So I think that's another potential parallel.
One of the things Ring talks about too, one of the common factors for people in both these camps is a lot of them had abuse growing up.
Mm. And that's, yes, that shows up a lot in the abductees. Yeah.
And as well as near-death experiences, which seems like such a weird thing, unless that abuse is somehow training our brains to move outside of this reality somehow, or just look for an escape somewhere.
Yeah, I think if you look at stories of children who are abused, or people who go through traumatic experiences who dissociate in some way, that it might, maybe it's a similar sort of reflex within the brain that is receptive to these experiences.
You know, so which came first, the chicken or the egg thing?
Right.
Did the traumatic events trigger, you know, I mean, basically the flying saucers looking down there and catching the psychic vibes off of people, and the folks that have been through trauma, you know, they can see it through the window of their UFO and they say, ah, there's one. Let's go and vector in on that, because they have the correct vibes that we can interact with, having been through trauma. Excuse me. Or is it like almost as if does it require the trauma to interact with them?
Right.
Hmm. And you know, it always bugged me with near-death experiences that not everyone has them.
Yeah.
You know? And then I wondered, is it like dreams? Because everyone dreams, but there are people who swear they don't because they simply don't remember them.
Yeah.
Sure. I mean, and then there's also exactly. I mean, the near-death experience stuff is funny because, you know, if you're given a choice to come back, right, and we don't have, you know, like the people who don't come back are the ones we can't talk to anymore.
Right. <so.
laughs> Right.
Right. Yeah. Everybody's brain is different, and everybody's moment of death is different. So even those who sort of hover on the fringe and then come back, I sort of think that maybe the near-death experience, you know, there's a part of everybody's brain that, or everybody's consciousness or brain, or however you want to think about it, that goes through that. But maybe people aren't tuned into it the same way. Something else was fear or pain was clouding clouding that moment for them, perhaps.
It's also possible that it has nothing to do with death.
Yes.
If it has nothing to do with death, what is it? You know, like if the actual death experience is completely different, if it's something else entirely, maybe we do just shut down and there's nothing else. What is the near-death experience in that case?
What is the UFO abduction experience? You know, what is the shamanic journey experience? What is, you know, taking a bunch of mushrooms? You know, I mean, it's an altered state of consciousness. Yeah. And with that comes all this other, you know, stuff that sort of gets stuck onto it, you know, all the preconceptions and the you know, obviously each one is different. A mushroom trip is going to be different than a near-death experience is going to be different than a UFO abduction.
Right.
But they are all an altered state of consciousness on one level.
Yeah. Graham.
And they're also all people are going there coming back with a message. I mean, the people who are coming back with the near death experience are coming back with just as much a message, and they're all changing the people.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
I mean, the people who you can almost tell the people who took acid in college, you know, like when you meet them like grown up now, you know, it's like, oh, good for you. Like, I get you. I get you perfectly, you know, and the people who don't, you know, you're kind of like, oh, you probably would have done you some good, you know. So,
but regardless of the trigger and regardless of the individual experience, it tends to be a transformational sort of thing, yeah. Regardless of how it manifests, whether it's a near-death experience or a shamanic journey or, you know, just tripping in a jungle somewhere. It's transformative for most people.
And the thing is, hallucinations don't transform people.
Right.
So, there has to be some pro, and even just someone using drugs recreationally is not going to go through that transformation. It seems like you need to connect to something for that transformation to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think we solved everything.
I think
good. We solved the whole UFO thing. Finally.
Right.
Finally.
And I thank both of you for coming on. Maybe we can do this again sometime. I mean, there's plenty of stuff we can. We didn't even touch on some of the stuff I wanted to get into. So this has been very interesting and a lot of fun.
Yes.
Great. Yeah, it was wonderful.
And Mike, why don't you start? Tell people where they can find your stuff and websites and stuff.
Yeah, I have an online site. If you Google my name, Mike Cleland, and then it'll come right up. But it's the name of the website is Hidden Experience. It's a blog, so you can just type in Hidden Experience blog. It'll come right up.
Okay. And Aaron?
My main web home is at ajgulyas.com, and I think it's linked on the Where Did the Road Go website. And my two sort of paranormally books that are out, the newest one, The Chaos Conundrum, from Red Star Books, and the previous one, Extraterrestrials in the American Zeitgeist, from McFarland Press, are both available through links on the website or on Amazon. Chaos Conundrum, Amazon's the best place to get it. E.T. in the American Zeitgeist is available literally wherever books are sold. AJGULYAS.com is sort of the hub for everything.
And projects you guys got coming up? Mike?
I'm working on a book right now. I wrote an essay that was posted last summer called Owls and the UFO Abductee, and turned into the foundation. That essay was the genesis of a book project that is keeping me very busy, and I'm completely lost and obsessed and swallowed up in owl research at this point.
Aaron?
And I'm working on this contract was just signed about a month ago. I'm working on it's going to be a big book for a scholarly press. It's about paranormal and conspiracy theory based science fiction television in the 1990s, and its interplay with actual conspiracy and paranormal culture in the 90s, and how the two influenced each other back and forth. So I'm spending my spring watching a whole lot of really good television and a whole lot of really, really bad television. If you remember the three episodes of Chris Carter's Harsh Realm that aired on Fox, know that there are 9 episodes that were even worse that didn't air. So that's the sort of thing that I'm dealing with right now.
Nice. Well, I thank you both for joining me tonight. And
thank you.
I think it was a great kickoff to year 2.
Yep.
Yeah, congratulations. Yeah, it's a big deal.
Yeah.
And I will have you both on sometime soon.
Excellent.
All right. Here's some last exit for the lost is up next. Here's some Psyche Corporation taking you out.
Come in. Do you read me? Do you understand the numbers pouring over your connection to perfection? 5, 8, 3. Have you heard the singing soaking into our transmission? 21, 34, 55, 89, 144. Into the heart of the universe, ventricles and atria, chambers numbered 1597 and counting. Can you hear?